Hi, I'm Ashley, and I'd like to welcome you to That Novel Feeling, the podcast where we talk reading, books, and more.
I am here today with USA Today bestselling romance author, Charis Michaels. Charis has written a number of historical romance novels, including A Duchess at Midnight, Any Groom Will Do, The Earl Next Door, and more. Say Yes to the Princess, which we will be discussing today, is the first novel in the new Hidden Royal series. Charis, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So before we begin chatting about Say Yes to the Princess, can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I am a native Texan. I now live up in Washington, D.C., or the D.C. metro area. I did live in London for 2 years when my husband was in graduate school, right after I was married when I was newlywed. I have two kids that are almost launched and a husband and two little half poodle dogs. Something interesting about me pertaining to romance is that immediately after college, I worked for 8 years for RWA, which I'm not even entirely sure what format RWA is in at the moment. There have been various iterations of it. But back in the day, I edited their trade journal and handled all their publicity. So before I was an author, I worked with authors for RWA. And that is a very special time in my life that I look on really fondly, all the authors that I got to meet and just how I got to kind of learn the industry from the inside out, like in reverse. And I started writing when I had my first child. I resigned from RWA and started writing, and it took me 10 years to publish. So I wrote 3 manuscripts, constantly revising them, sending them back out. And about 10 years in, I finaled in what was RWA's Golden Heart at the time. By then, I was no longer on staff. I was just a member. And I, as a result of finaling, my buddy, Lenora Bell, won. She was also a finalist in my category. But as part of finaling, I pitched the book to an editor, Chelsea Immelhaus at HarperCollins, Avon. And that was my first sale 10 years after starting.
I love that story. And it's kind of a full circle moment. You started working with romance authors and now you are one.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride, but I have been working in and around this industry since I was 22 years old. So long history with it.
So when did your love of reading begin? And when did you know that you wanted to become an author? Like, when did you know you wanted to write instead of only working with books?
Well, my origin story, I think, as a romance novelist is when I read a book in 1989. I was 16 years old. I read Almost Heaven by Judith McNaught. And she's considered old school, and she is in fact very old school now. But that was a real life-changing book for me because I saw my own self and my own values and my own just sort of the things I was passionate about reflected just almost in pristine clarity on the pages of that book. And that's kind of when I decided this is a job. This is the job that I want to do. And because I've been writing since I was little. And so when I saw that I could parlay my writing into stories and values that really resonated with me, that is when I locked in on that. So I studied journalism in college and reading hundreds and hundreds of romance novels, just literally consuming them as a reader, really not yet looking at them technically, like, how might I do this? Just enjoying it. And then got an internship at RWA. I was a native Texan, as I mentioned, and RWA was based in Houston. And then after that internship, I graduated and worked there full time. So in terms of reading, it's almost like it was almost just the industry as a whole and the fact that these are love stories and that these are stories written by women for women. And I was working with them behind the scenes and getting to know how they were as businesswomen and how they were as just creatives. That was informing me. My first book was Almost Heaven. Other influences would be the Navy SEAL series and Troubleshooter series from Suzanne Brockman. She has this romantic suspense series. All this is kind of from the 90s because that was my sweet spot from when I was reading. Loretta Chase is every historical romance novelist's favorite, I think, but definitely Lord of the Scoundrels, I consider to be the greatest historical romance. And so that was a really benchmark book for me. And then there's an author even that predates Judith McNaught called Laura Kinsale, and her writing in particular, you know, I love the tone of Judith McNaught. I love the voice of Loretta Chase. I love the plot and the characters of Suzanne Brockman. And what I love about Laura Kinsale is literally the fine writing and the world building. So those are some of my favorite authors, and just literally their whole backlist.
I love that. I'm going to have to check out that romantic suspense series. I love a good romantic suspense.
Oh my gosh, it will change your life. Let me see if I can remember the first book. Book one is called Unsung Hero. Book one is Unsung Hero. It follows the SEAL team, and it's like each of them fall in love. And it's groundbreaking in so many ways because it has a spinoff series with, if I'm not mistaken, the first male-male romance in it. And she just handles all of it so beautifully. And that whole series, that's probably 12 to 16 books. So I love when I discover a new author and they have this huge backlist.
Well, I'm excited now. And yes, I won't have to wait for the next book to come out. I don't mind waiting sometimes, but sometimes it's nice to just read them all at once.
I just discovered, and I'm late to the game on this, but Anika Martin's Billionaires in Manhattan series. I'm late to the game on it, and I just am binging those billionaire books back to back. They're so good. Although I write historical romance, I like to read what is not historical romance. And I'll read like Julianne Long, I'll read immediately as soon as she has a book come out. But for the most part, when I'm reading, I don't read historical just because it kind of messes up what I'm thinking about with my own book. So that Contemporary Billionaires series, oh my gosh. And there's so many books. So
one author that I've recently come across is Emily McIntyre. That's the one I'm super late to the game on. She has their darker romance based on Disney. Peter Pan is the first one. Lion King is the second one. It's really, really good. I've read the first one so far, Hooked, and it's fantastic. But yeah, I wouldn't say it's based on, it's inspired by.
Right. Well, I have a fairy tale series that I call fairy tale adjacent. Is it contemporary or is it fantasy or is it historical?
It's contemporary and it's dark romance. So yes. It's not like darker themes, but
yes,
it's really good.
Okay.
So what are some books that have had the biggest impact on you throughout your life?
Well, Lord of the Scoundrels, which we've mentioned, Almost Heaven, which we've mentioned. I actually read a lot of general fiction and literature. It really helps fill the well for me and just makes me a better writer. And I just enjoy it. So my favorite book of all times is called News of the World by Paulette Giles. And it's a historical fiction. It does have a little love story in it, honestly, but it is was made into a movie starring Tom Hanks, but it came out during COVID and I don't know if many people saw it, and the book is far better. But that's a like 1890s set Texas history book. That is one of my favorite books. The Australian author, Leanne Moriarty, I think I'm saying that right. So she writes what I think we would all consider to be women's fiction or kind of women's fiction thrillers. And I absolutely marvel at her books technically and just how well she writes her characters and writes her plots, and they're long books. And sometimes when you read an author who writes a really long book, by the time you get to the last eighth, you can tell they're ready to be done and they're just racing to the end. And she just pulls it right on out and stretches it like she just has nothing to do but write. One of my favorites of hers is called What Alice Forgot. It's about a woman who falls off the treadmill and hits her head. And when she comes to, she has the type of amnesia that she knows who she is, but she thinks she is 15 years in the past. So she's in fact divorced and she doesn't realize it. She's still in love with her husband and doesn't know that they're divorced, but really that her whole backlist. Yeah. Those are some of my favorites.
What Alice Forgot? That was also turned into a film, wasn't it, with Julianne Moore? I think.
I have not seen that turned into a movie. Julianne Moore did a movie, and it may have Alice in the title, but it is about Alzheimer's or dementia. And this book is literally, it's amnesia trope. And I don't want to tell you how it ends, but it's not quite as clinically heavy as the movie you're talking about. So Anne Moriarty, her books that are made into films have been, that squad of like Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman and Laura Dern, and they so that's sort of her troupe that remakes her books into movies. Also, the book is better in those instances.
I've read that book and it's going to drive me insane because I know exactly what you're talking about. And then also, Nine Perfect Strangers was another one of her books, I think, right? That
Yes.
got turned into, what was that one? Oh my goodness.
It's a bunch of, it's like three short words, like I don't
Yeah,
remember.
I know. I can picture the, don't you hate when I can picture the cover? I can everything. But, anyways, so let's chat about the romance industry for a second. So, people can sometimes be very dismissive of the romance genre in general and have a habit of not taking it seriously. I personally think that the genre is important for so many reasons. And I'm quick to remind people that romance is the best-selling and most profitable genre, on top of bringing so many people together. So why do you think that this genre is so important?
This is a great question. And my first answer is not dismissive, but it definitely speaks to just saying to all those people, deal with yourselves. Because I spent so much of my time at RWA defending romance and justifying romance and like finding examples of romance being studied at graduate school and colleges. And then I just sort of thought, you know what? I'm laughing all the way to the bank. I'm laughing all the way to the end of this book that I love, and I don't care, and I don't need to defend it anymore. And that's kind of what I will mostly say when people ask this question. You know what? It's not for you. Too bad, your loss. However, there's also another answer, and that is that all genre fiction, and so genre fiction I consider to be romance, mysteries, thrillers, including legal thrillers, westerns, if you want to go that far, and horror. And all genre fiction is a character study about characters that we love and that resonate with us. So, and then there's this element of suspense. So, in a mystery, there's a dead body and we're trying to figure out who did it, but we're really enjoying the character of the detective or the other people in the cast. In a thriller, the suspense is, will we save the vice president, or will we find the nuclear codes, or will we figure out who's secretly living in the attic? And so that's the suspense, but the characters and their lives are what keeps that resonates with us. In a romance, the suspense is, will they or won't they? And if they do, how will that happen? But it's really all these books are character studies. And so when you look at romance like that, romance in particular, when it studies characters, it celebrates things that are pro-woman. And that is relationships. And it can be love relationships, absolutely. But these books also have like a huge found family or an existing family component to them. So it celebrates sister relationships and mother-daughter and friends and neighbors. And it also frequently explores women as a caregiver, whether we're taking care of a parent or we're taking care of people at our office or all the different ways that women are relied on to care give for, for better or for worse. It celebrates things like even makeovers and looking cute if that's what you're into, or making your space look stylish. That's a like can be considered a distinctly woman sort of value, and that is something that romance explores. And so when you read a book and you see your own values reflected back at you, you begin to realize I matter. this is really resonating with me because the way I feel and the things that I value are important to me. And look, they're important to everyone who reads this book and to the author who reads this book. And I think who wrote this book. And I think it just feels really good to read a book that just sort of mirrors you back to yourself and all the things that you love, or many of the things that you love. And this is a generalization, but it's a generalization that is true. And because romance is so vast, you know, we have a wide variety of those values that are reflected. You mentioned dark romance before. That's not really my thing. My books are kind of cheerful and bright. And so if you want to dial up cheerful and bright, then you read my book and see those types of things reflected. If you like suspensier and spicier and darker things, then you can read that. But what it is, it's just saying the things that matter to you matter to others, and we're going to celebrate them in this book. And then also just the hopefulness piece of them. I mean, I think that women, I mean, I know in my own life, I've got teenagers, I've got parents getting older, I have, you know, a dog that's sick. And so my life is a lot of worry and struggle and anxiety. And when I do leisure reading, I would love to have that guarantee that this book is going to end on a hopeful note. If I read in the description on the back of the book or in a review, and it just says devastating, or you'll be gutted by this book, I'm like, glad just keep right on walking, because I have plenty of that. And I'm devastated enough as I walk down the street in today's climate. So I don't need my book to also devastate me. I need it to reflect myself, resonate with me, and be hopeful. And I really think that's romance just does a wonderful job of that for women in particular. And not that men don't enjoy it, and not that every woman will, but many women do.
And I think, like you said, it's such a vast genre that there really is something for just about everybody. And you said it earlier, and I agree. And I love the fact that it is by women, about women, for women. So that's very empowering.
Yeah, it is. And again, if you don't like to read about people falling in love, then the genre, and it goes back to my first point, the genre's not for you. Read about dead bodies and who did it, and good for you. And we'll just do what we're doing.
Absolutely. So moving on now to Say Yes to the Princess, the first installment of your new Hidden Royals series. Can you tell us what this novel is about for those who have not yet read it?
Right. So this is, like you said, book one in my Hidden Royals series. And this series is about three royal siblings. It's two sisters and a brother. And they were exiled to Britain as children or young adults. And so they grew up British, basically. However, they were secretly royal, and two of them know that they're royal, but the baby, the book three, the baby, she came when she was so little. She doesn't, that's going to be like the trope there will be like discovering your royalty. But book one, Say Yes to the Princess, the heroine was 15 when she came to England. And so she'd already debuted in her home country, which was France. And so she was out in society. So instead of like hiding her, she actually went to live with the British royal family. And so at the beginning of the book, she is exiling in St. James's Palace, but she's kind of like that house guest that everyone's grown tired of and that no one wants. But no one really says that. It's sort of like they don't know what to do with her. And because of the trauma she experienced fleeing France, she also is very quiet and she kind of keeps to herself. And she has a couple of ladies in waiting that are her friends, but mostly she's just sort of almost erased. But before the book starts, she makes a random sighting of a guy she believes, a gentleman, man that she believes to be her brother, because all the kids were separated when they fled France. So she sees someone that she thinks is her brother, and it like invigorates her to leave exile, leave the palace, find this person, and rejoin her family. And then the hero of the book is the royal fixer. So he is hired by the royal family to solve problems that the police or a soldier or a guard or a lawyer or a barrister or just someone giving a stern talking to can't solve. So he's sort of brought in for messy, sticky situations. And so they bring him to try to contain her for reasons that are explained later in the book. So we have, and the charge that they give this guy is like, you can't really lock her away and we can't really like punish her or threaten her because she's in fact a princess. However, why don't you distract her? Why don't you like try to seduce her so that she is so dazzled that she stops looking for her brother and she stops escaping the palace. And so he's just supposed to sort of like be a fake boyfriend that only he knows about. But then he meets her and he doesn't know if he can see this through. And she, not to spoil it, but she sees through immediately that he is not what he seems. So I just mentioned that because books with a big secret with a capital S are frustrating to me and to many readers, I think. And so like the secret of what he's doing in full, or at least in part, I should say, is revealed right away between the two of them. And that's the book. That's the setup.
I adore this book and I cannot wait for the next two. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you. I can't either. The middle book is written and I'm writing the third book now, and it's been a lot of fun.
So in the afterword of your book, you state that the idea for this series actually came from your neighbor, Michelle, who told you about a podcast called Noble Blood. Can you tell us more about how the series came to be in the first place?
Sure. What a great question. So when we, not to back up too far, but when we go back to contract, we bring our previously, things are always changing in publishing, but we would bring an idea for two or three books that are an interconnected series, and you need a killer hook for that. That's the most important thing, down to the name of the hook or the name of the series and even the titles of the books. And the books you kind of only loosely pitch what they're about. It's more like, how can we market it? How can we sell it? How can we describe it in a few words? So when I was going to go back to contract after Awakened by a Kiss, which was, in my opinion, a great series with a great hook, which was fairy tale sidekicks, like retelling or fairy tale adjacent, inspired by fairy tale sidekicks, you know, Tinkerbell from Cinderella and stepsister, or Tinkerbell from Peter Pan, the stepsister from Cinderella. So that worked really well for me. And I was just like, what in the world can I follow this up with? So I was looking for something that the title was catchy. And what you want with a hook is a known thing that you can give a new spin to, because we all, you know, one of the many reasons we love Barbie this summer is that Barbie is a known thing. And so we don't have to reinvent the wheel in our mind about what it's going to be about. So my neighbor, Michelle, was listening to Noble Blood, which is a podcast about like royalty all over the world. So Hawaiian royalty, Asian royalty, Germanic royalty, African royalty, any type of royalty that you can imagine, is, and including British and French. And every episode is one little like nugget of a story, and it's, you know, royalty beheaded, royalty in a, locked in a tower, royalty separated at birth, royalty that gets murdered, royalty that gets proven that they're not in fact royal. And they're fascinating little historical capsules. And so I was, Michelle said, what about something like secret royals or hidden royals? And I was like, hidden royals, that's it. I didn't even know what it was going to be about. I just felt like this is a hook. Royalty is a known thing. I like the idea of discovering like accidentally royal. And so then I began to think, so I had the name, right? And so then I began to think like, why are they hidden? Who are they? Are they? And I felt like it would be too much of a stretch to write about British royalty because I didn't want to monkey with the history that much. So then I decided I was going to invent a country somewhere like Mondrovia or something in somewhere in Europe. And my agent said, why don't you figure out like if, you know, who was really exiling in Europe at the time and base it on reality. And that was just the best piece of advice because the book was so much easier to write and fun to flesh out with, you know, the existing history about, because in reality, there were exiled royalty living all over Europe at the time because of the French Revolution. And so then I thought, okay, I didn't want my hidden royals to be from another country. I mean, to be foreigners in Britain. So I didn't want them to have a language barrier, and I didn't want them to dress in a way that was like, you know, we're wearing our native costume and it doesn't fit in with the styles of Regency England. Cause I find that distracting. When you want Regency, you want literally the British Regency. And so I wanted them to have been in Britain for a while. And I needed to figure out all the different ways they could be hidden. And so then I just sort of started monkeying with, well, one is going to be older and living in a palace. I guess I should say that that's when I began to explore the history and figure out where people were really exiling and how they were doing it. And that is when I came up with my three hidden royals and how they would look in the books.
I'm definitely going to check out that podcast. I love history, and I especially.
Oh my gosh. It is so good. It's really good. And it starts out, I think, like the first eight are the wives of Henry VIII, or the first five. And it just goes into why they were chosen and how they were killed, and just fascinating.
So you touched on it earlier, but the novel begins with us meeting Killian and Elise as he is following her as she traipses through London dressed all in black with her entourage. In certain ways, Elise is quite unconventional for the time and is such an interesting character. She knows what she wants and is single-minded in her determination to get it. Where did you draw the inspiration for Elise?
Well, the short answer is I always find some public figure and paste them up on how I'm just sort of describing the vibe and definitely the look. And so for Elise, I needed someone who looked French. I actually used actress Ana de Armas, and she's, I think, a Spaniard, but same idea. And so she was what I looked at when I was describing Elise. But honestly, all of Sherris Michaels' heroines are pretty much the same. They are not the same, but they have a sameness to them. So they're all confident. They're all determined. They're pretty bossy. They are, I guess what they're not is the best way to describe them. I get very frustrated by a wishy-washy heroine who like is wringing her hands and she can't decide and she doesn't really know. And she's sort of waiting for life to happen to her. My heroines are always, they have a goal. They're going to accomplish it. And they may have like weaknesses or faults or even self-doubt, but they're generally not shrinking violets who are sitting around waiting for someone to come in and make some adventure for them. And that is me. Like I've just described myself, I'm pretty decisive and I'm pretty determined, sometimes to my detriment. And so they're kind of modeled not on me, but on the type of woman that I would hope to be on my best day.
I love that. And in that same vein, what are some of your favorite romance novels with strong and independent female characters?
You know, one thing I want to say is that like a side note to my strong, I hesitate to label them too spirited or determined because readers don't necessarily sometimes like a forceful heroine or a heroine that's resistant to love. My heroines are always all about falling in love and all about being what, you know, the hero will have a wound and they are definitely into repairing that wound for him. And so, or repairing that wound together, I should say. So I want to make sure that we say that they're determined, but they're not, they're not so strong that they don't have a soft part or a soft center or even a softness whenever that's called for. My favorite heroine is Jessica Trent from Lord of the Scoundrels. She is absolutely pitch perfect to me. She is ready to fall in love. She's also perfectly confident and she's not passive aggressive. She's a little passive aggressive in the end, but she's not pouty. She doesn't feel sorry for herself. She doesn't have to go and lick her wounds. She kind of has, the hero is really strong, obviously alpha guy, but he is no match for her. And yet she's ready to please him and be pleased by him. And so I would say she's my favorite. Like I tried to come up with some other names when I was reading how we were going to talk about this interview. And I couldn't come up with anyone more perfect than Jessica Trent, honestly. She's my favorite.
I love that. And yes, I would say your characters are very intelligent and they're flawed. They're so relatable. Your
Oh,
characters
good.
are intelligent and relatable. That's what I
I
love.
never would want to write a heroine that you wouldn't want to be friends with. And there are some women that are too prickly for me. And, we need those women in the world, or too strident. We absolutely need those women in the world. And I'm so glad that they're there. But if they don't have a soft, vulnerable part, then it's hard for me to be friends with them in life. And, go on with your bad self. I'm so glad you're like that woman. But I don't want to write a heroine that I couldn't be friends with myself.
Yeah, well, that absolutely makes sense. So we talked a little bit about your research process earlier, but this novel takes place in the early 1800s. I love the descriptions of the court, the gardens, the fashion, the estates. I love anything historical, honestly. So having said that, I can only imagine the amount of research that would need to go into novels such as this. So what does that research process look like for you? And what are some of your favorite resources when it comes to historical fiction research?
Right. This is another great question. So for this book in particular, my first challenge was figuring out where my hidden royals exiled from. And so for that, because I was resistant to use France when I started, because the French Revolution is not sexy, it's terrible, and it's overdone. And honestly, there are some Americans who have a block against French people. They find them to be rude or difficult or whatever it is. And it's also such a known thing, and people are familiar with the history. Even if they've watched Les Mis, they know a little bit about the history, and it's easier to write about an obscure thing that no one knows about. However, I read this book called Grandmama of Europe, which is about Queen Victoria and all of her grandchildren. So this is about 80 years or 70, 50 to 70 years after when my book would be set. But it was such a wonder. This is such a great book, but it was an overview of all the different countries that Victoria and Albert were trying to marry their children and grandchildren off to. And so it gave me a view and a little bit, not exactly, the lines are not exactly the same in 1803 or whenever the book was set, I can't remember, but it was basically the same Europe. And so I was able to say, okay, Bavaria, which is not in a country now, is a country, and Liechtenstein. And I was, because the book is about how absolutely important it is for the ruling royal families of Europe to keep royalty all in the blood all pure. And it was an alarming book because, oh my gosh, these people were intermarried and they're marrying their first cousins like again and again. And the birth defects were just like off the charts, like weird things like bleeding from your navel and just no hair. And it just bizarre, bless their hearts, these kids that were just all married to their relatives. But that's a side note of I was able to get a view of all the countries that were out there because they're always talking about who was appropriate to marry whom. So one prince and princess, prince, one family kept coming up, and it was the prince and princess of, oh my gosh, so hard for me to say it, and I have it, and then I don't have it. The Laurents, that is the way you say their name. And I kept thinking, like, what country is this, De Laurents? Like, are they, what are they? And so I started researching them based on when Queen Victoria would have a grandchild marry one of them in this book that I'd read. And I was like, oh, they're French. And then I began to realize that the French royal family doesn't just stop with the king and the queen and their children. There are all these like cadet branches, they call it, of the royal family. And so the De Laurents are one of those cadet branches, and they're still considered royal, even though they're not like one of the main guys. So I started to look closer at the De Laurents and how they exiled and what happened with them during the French Revolution, and I locked in on them. So I used that book to pick out who my royals were. Then I read Marie Terre's Child of Terror by Susan Nagel, which is a book about, so when Marie Antoinette and King Louis had their head chopped off, they had three children, one princess and two little boys. And the boys were imprisoned and died. And the princess was imprisoned for a long time, but she was finally released to enter exile. And this book is about what her exile was like. So that informed what exile was like for a French royal. And because it also talked about her cousins and the other people that were like aristocratic and royal in France and how they exiled. So that's how I got that. I watched Ray Donovan, which is a television show on Showtime, and it is about a Hollywood fixer. So that informed so much of my hero, because even though it's modern day and he was fixing in Hollywood and taking care of celebrities and taking care of producers and just kind of doing things that the police couldn't do or that couldn't be hired out to a lawyer, he was just kind of like the hired muscle that went in and hid the dead bodies and got rid of the people that weren't supposed to be hanging around set. And that really informed the hero's character. There's a book called A Royal Experience, The Private Life of King George III. And anybody writing Regency that is going to touch on King George, his madness, the Prince of Wales, later the Prince Regent, and all of those children, I can't remember, 9, 11, 12, how many of them survived. This is an essential book. And just even the first page is like the family tree, and it shows all of them and how long they lived and who they married or who they didn't marry. And I had that book open the entire time I was writing, just literally to that family tree. So it was a lot of different books and watching Ray Donovan, which is an absolute pleasure. I highly recommend this show. And yeah, that was my research.
I will list all of those books in the show notes for anyone interested. But the one about Marie Antoinette's daughter, I need to get to that one soon because that sounds fascinating.
It was really fascinating.
And in the same vein, with all of the research that you need to do for these books, I know that all of it cannot make it into the stories. So how do you determine what you use in the novel and what gets left behind?
Another great question. So I like to use the analogy of cooking. So like if I'm going to make like some kind of vegetable casserole, the vegetable is there and it's a known thing. And the oil or the butter is a known thing. The cheese is a known thing. But the spices that I would use on that are not always a flavor that you can identify. Sometimes you can say, oh, it's rosemary or oh, it's saffron. But the spice that you put in the vegetable is so crucial to the flavor of it, but it's like an underlying, totally woven in, subtle thing. And that's the way history works best in current historical romance. You do not want long descriptions. You do not want it to overpower it. The main story is the relationship, but you got to have it always there, that history, and you have to have it accurate. And my first book, The Earl Next Door, I made a big error of discussing the Bow Street Runners before the Bow Street Runners came into being. By about five or eight years. And a reader called me out in a review, and I vowed then to do everything I could to get it right. Like if I'm writing in history, I need to try to get it as accurate as I can, because I think that's a fun part of the book. Or if not, I need to say why I've changed it. But get it right, but just don't hit the readers over the head with it. It's got to be like a world building flavor thing. It doesn't need to be an entire set piece. The other part of it, though, is it helps me plot. So an example of this is in the book, even though these three children are exiled, they have a mother and she is not involved at all. She fled France with her lover and went back to Spain, where she had been a Spanish princess. And this actually happened in the Dolorans family. This is what the mother did. She left them and left them to their own devices in exile. And And I've had people in reviews write, the relationship with the mother is not clear. And I really don't think this would happen, that the mother would be so uninvolved. And I'm thinking, like, this actually happened in life. So this is just the way it was. Everybody sort of fled for their lives during the French Revolution and, you know, had to fend for themselves. You know, use it for plotting and flavor it throughout. But other than that, don't let it carry the story away, would be my answer about research.
I love that analogy. I've never heard it described that way, but I think it like explains it perfectly.
Yeah, that is a good example from someone who doesn't like to cook, but I get the main idea.
So while Elise was offered sanctuary with the Prince of Wales and Queen Charlotte, she reflects that she feels displaced, purposeless, and idle, and that she had worn out her welcome. While it is easy to think that life in the palace would have been easy and wonderful, that is definitely not the truth of it. What would life have been like in actuality for someone like Elise, a displaced French princess, during that time?
So part of my research that wasn't in a book was literally on the internet. Although I did read a diary of one of the de Lorraine's princes. They did everything. One of them, the de Lorraine's family in particular, the one that was the closest to the throne. So he's sort of modeled around, or the hero of the middle book is sort of modeled kind of loosely around him. He lived in barns for years. He would move to a different barn every couple of days and sleep in the hayloft. He became a blacksmith. He went to Philadelphia in America for a time. He was friends with the Prince of Wales, like it says in the book. I mean, it's sort of referred to in the book, or his father was. And so he came and hung out with the British royal family for a time. It was really a mixed bag. I mostly drew on Marie Antoinette and Louis's daughter. She just hung out. She was bored. She wrote letters to her relatives. When can we leave exile? What's going to happen to us next? And then a large part of what they were doing was just trying to let everyone remember, we're actually royalty. We're hiding right now, but when the time comes, it's going to be us. And don't forget, our blood is pure. So it's a lot of like, you know, there were no passports or, you know, fingerprint IDs to prove I am the, and so there were imposters cropping up and they were saying, oh, I'm the person, the royal person, when in reality they were hiding in a chalet somewhere. They did a lot of staying with friends, staying in other courts, like the heroine of my first book did, just sort of nowhere to rest your head. And they didn't have a ton of money. And so they were truly just adrift, you know, with what they could carry and then what people were willing to do for them. The rest of Europe was so terrified that their common people were going to revolt and try to chop off their heads that they were pretty sympathetic for a time with all of the aristocratic French exiles. They did take them in, but everybody wears out their welcome and they're expensive. So their court was super pared down, their servants, it was just sometimes themselves or just one lady's maid. And the de Lorraine's brothers were living rough. They were kind of itinerant.
I always find it so fascinating, no matter the time period, to learn about how, or even today, like in other places, how people live, like in actuality. Because I feel like so many times we have an image of like what life as a princess would be, and it's really probably nothing like what we think.
Maria Therese read her Bible almost all day long and then read her prayer book and then wrote letters and then walked in the garden and then went to bed. It was terrible.
Yeah, that does not sound good at all. So one of the things that I adore about this book is the side characters, the secondary characters. So I adore both Hodges and Marie. Hodges being employed by Killian and his right-hand man, really, and Marie being Elise's friend and one of her ladies-in-waiting. I found both Hodges and Marie so interesting, and I hope we get more of their stories in the upcoming books. But having said that, what do you think that this story would have lacked without Hodges and Marie in it?
Another great question. So Hodges and Marie and every servant or friend in a romance novel, they serve the purpose of allowing dialogue to happen. So a lot has to be explained, especially at the beginning of the book, the exposition, the backstory. Now, as a writer, I can say, and she all the things. But if I have her say it in dialogue to her friend or her cousin or Marie, the nun, then we're reading it. And we all know when we're reading a book and we skip a bunch of just prose and go straight to read the dialogue. For whatever reason, dialogue is fun, more fun to read. And it just does a better job of painting a picture than just reading. And then this happened and then this happened. So you will always find, at least in my books, a cousin or a friend or a neighbor or a servant that they can talk to. And that's how I explain so much of the story. So Hodges, you know, and again, my editor frequently will have me pare down sideline characters because we really need to focus on the hero and heroine. So Hodges is cute, but he's not, in my mind, he was there for the purpose of dialogue. And he ended up being the hero's uncle. And I thought that was a neat part of it. He was just a faithful servant. And mostly he was just handy. Marie, I adored and based her loosely on, so in Ray Donovan, the Showtime series about the Fixer, he has a Girl Friday. Who's this incredibly tough ex-convict lesbian named Lena. And I loved her character, and that's who I based Marie on. And she is in the next book. Not much, but enough to be useful. And I'm glad that you liked her because I was so very fond of her and just how badass she was, even, you know, as a nun. And I love taking sort of known expected things and showing that they can have that role, but be, you know, in an exciting new way.
Yeah, that complexity is what makes me love them. And I do. I'm excited to see Marie again. So at dinner with Killian's nephew, Bartholomew, Killian must explain to Bart that a large part of being a gentleman is compassion. You must be mindful of the impact of the things you say. Not every idea in your head needs to be expressed, especially to guests at dinner. So this is a sentiment that I find that some people of the modern day, especially on social media, no longer believe. What do you think the appropriate balance between telling others what you think and keeping your thoughts to yourself lay?
That's another great question. If I can just pull back from it, though, for a second, technically, the purpose of that scene was manyfold, but I knew that I needed to get Elise's trauma out there. And, you know, she can have a moment where she's alone with the hero and she finally reveals, this is what it was like when my father was beheaded. And this is what it was like when we fled France. You know, when Killian talks about his wound, it's just the two of them. But I wanted to do hers in a different way, just for variety's sake. And also it fit in the story right then. So I decided to have her tell her trauma to this table of strangers. And in order for her to say that, I had to have this little boy drawing her out. So much of the function of what Killian is doing is just what any guardian would do if your kid is being rude. But what I was trying to say with that point in particular, I mean, so much of these books have to do with rank and aristocracy and being a gentleman and a lady. And to me, and I think this is also true of the time, based on reading Jane Austen, being a gentleman and being a lady definitely has to do with your heredity, but it also has to do with your manners. And so I love to explore what it means to have manners. And I don't just mean like, do you slurp your soup? Although I do think it's important not to drag into social situations and be, you know, your worst self. It's not respectful to the people that you're around. But I think truly what manners are and what Killian was trying to say to his nephew was, how are you making other people feel when you talk to them? Are you embarrassing them? Are you making them feel less than? Are you trying to, with your comment, make a point about your own superiority, but framing it so that the other person feels embarrassed or ashamed or literally anything other than uplifted? And that to me is the root of manners, is just making other people feel comfortable and making other people feel that life is not as hard as it can sometimes be. Like, don't go into a situation and make life harder for the other person. Manners are making life easier. And Bartholomew, you know, and she says that these questions are coming with a pure heart. He wasn't trying to embarrass her and he wasn't trying to drag her through a bunch of pain. He was a little boy. But, you know, off the page, Killian talks to his nephew later. And in my mind, what he tells him is, we just need to make sure that we are lifting other people up and not making them feel bad. And that's what it means to be a gentleman. And that's what it means to be an effective leader, which is what you would hope an aristocrat would be. If you remember, there's a scene in Emma where Mr. Knightley admonishes and sort of mansplains to Emma how she has embarrassed a neighbor. And it has to do with Emma kind of shaming the neighbor who's annoying and who was saying things that anybody would get tired of hearing. And Emma sort of mouths off to her in a way that embarrasses the older woman. And it was a little bit of a win for Emma, I think, in her mind at that moment, because she shut her up. And later, Mr. Knightley takes her to the side and explains to her why that was really bad form. And it's great because it creates like conflict in the third act of that book, but it also is just a great point about what Jane Austen thought and hopefully what the pervading view of the day was about what manners truly mean. And that is, if you have any elevated rank at all, you need to go in with an abundance of generosity of spirit, everyone that you speak to. And that is manners. And that is what Killian was trying to tell Bartholomew, in my mind.
I love that. And that's one of my favorite scenes in the book. There are many, but that is one of my favorites. I love little Bart. I just love him.
It's mine too. And it was so fun to write.
So there's a quote in the novel, one of many that I love, and it is, boldness does not necessarily mean braveness. Can you expand on that?
Yes. So that little sentence was put in there really when I was writing, I remember the exact moment when that paragraph, for rhythmic reason. So the paragraph above it is long and blah, 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 blah. And I'm explaining how she changed from being a quiet little mouse to being invigorated to find her brother. And the paragraph simply needed a little staccato thing at the end. And so I actually toyed with braveness is not necessarily boldness. And I thought, wait, is that true? And then I switched it. Boldness is not necessarily braveness. Because I wanted it to also say something as well. And I think it just means that Elise was able to call up this boldness, but she was still very afraid to step out of what her life had been like in exile. And the flip side of that would be she was brave, but she was timid. And that wasn't what she was having. That wasn't her experience. So I switched it back and I said, boldness was not necessarily braveness. Is that right? Whichever one I did that said she was able to put herself out there, but the courage was coming in drips and drabs more.
She had a quiet bravery.
Yes.
She started with that. So the love scenes between Killian and Elise were perfection. You captured the nervous anticipation, the chemistry, the excitement, the vulnerability. It is not an easy thing to do. So what do you look for in a good love scene in a romance novel?
You know, love scenes are a challenge for me. And I just pray that that doesn't come through on the page, because I think some people are absolute geniuses at it. I think I write a perfectly good book, but there are plenty of parts that may be better than my love scenes just because they are a challenge for me. And I really don't know what the source of that is. But when I come to them, I have to sort of like brace. Okay, and now I'm going to make this happen. I always want them to forward the plot. So you won't see a bunch of titillizing sort of gratuitous love scenes in my books. Not that there's anything wrong with that. We all love those books, but that's not my book. So it's got to forward the plot. And I want something to be revealed about character in my books. I love a virgin heroine so much that my first editor asked me if I had like a virgin fetish. And so no, but I do love a virgin heroine. Number one, I get stressed. It makes me, heroines that have been sexually active before stress me out just because the rules of the day, it would have just been super rare. And it also would have been super risky. And so it just doesn't necessarily seem to fit. And then I also love a virgin heroine because there's this sort of like teacher, instructor, student kind of dynamic going on that I find to be really sexy, especially when my heroines are so confident and so sort of bossy that in a love scene, at least they shut up and they take the backseat and let the hero take command. And that's sexy to me. And so, because my heroes so far have not been virgins, so they're experienced and they're sort of like teaching and showing the ropes. And there's a power dynamic there that I find very sensual. And I don't know, I put my spice at sort of medium. So I have an open door and the love scene is fully explicitly described, but it doesn't, I don't use really explicit language. And so I think that keeps it back a little bit, but it's the right level for me. I'm glad you liked it. I liked it. This is my first ever heroine who had sex with the hero before they were married. Before, it just feels safer to me as a reader and a writer when everyone is married and no one can be like ruined and get pregnant. And it stresses me out when they're not married just because of all the societal rules. And again, I'm reading these books for hopefulness, not to be stressed out. But it fit with the book for them to go ahead, and that's what they did.
Yes. And I love your scenes too, because like you said, they do forward the book and the story. It shows their connection and their vulnerability in a way that not many other, there's a special vulnerability to that. And then that comes through and it shows their connection in a deeper way. So I love your,
That's a great point. I've never thought about it that way. And people often ask like, why does it have to have graphically described love scenes? And I always say, well, do you like to have dinner without dessert? We're having a full meal here and we have the bread and we have the meat and we have the potatoes and we have the vegetables and we have the salad. And you know what? Now we're having dessert, and it wouldn't be a treat and a delight and a full feast if we didn't have all of it. But in addition to that, there is a special deepness and vulnerability that only happens in bed that comes out in the love scenes. I've never thought of that before. So good for you. I'm going to use that.
So throughout the book, there were various instances where I laughed out loud. And one being when Edward was introducing Killian to Elise. Another being the delightful dinner with Bartholomew. I love Bart. So why was it important for you to add humor into the story? And what were some of the challenges of doing so, as humor is both a talent and a craft?
It's one of those things that just shows up. I love a funny book. You mentioned dark romances before. I really don't, that's not, as a reader, that's not for me. And those books are great. And I am happy for the people who read them and who write them. And I'm so impressed. My books are funny and they're light and they're charming and they're whimsical. And in life, I comment in my texts and in my thank you notes and in my letters and in driving down the road, if anyone's in the car, I'm always making satirical comments about life. And so it just comes natural to me. I'm so glad you thought it was funny. I laugh when I'm writing it. I feel like Joan Wilder at the end of Romancing the Stone. She's like, read it and weep. I always do.
Okay, so I'm laughing because that movie is one of my favorite movies. And Jewel of the Nile, the next one. I have watched it so many times. My husband will look at me and he'll be like, do you want to watch a movie? I'm like, yes. He's like, no, not that one again. I think he can recite the whole thing at this point. So are you able to share anything about what you are currently working on? You mentioned that the second book in the series is written and you're working on the third already.
Right. So the second one is with my editor. I turned it in at the beginning of the summer. And so she's working on it and I will revise it literally any day. And so I'll get it and I'll have several weeks to read the whole thing again and work on the weak spots and polish it. I can't wait to get it back. At this point, I don't even remember. It'll be like reading a new book whenever I get it back. And that's about the brother. He is in fact a horse whisperer, as he sort of suggested in book one, and he has been living in a cave, which is something that happened to exiled French aristocrats. So he's been living in a cave. He's been in England since he was 8, and he knows he is a prince, but he doesn't feel safe telling anyone. So he keeps it a secret. And the trope here is kind of like, raised by wolves. So he's like a super manly cave dwelling man. And book three is about Danny, the little sister. And so she's just been raised by kindly surrogate parents in a cottage in Kent. And she doesn't even know she's a princess. And she and the hero get married like on the first page, or they get betrothed on the first page. So it's like married to a stranger is the trope in that. And he is to tell her that she's a princess. I'm really only 25 pages into that one. So I'm still discovering it myself.
Oh, I'm so excited. I cannot wait.
I'm excited for this series. The middle book is a lot of fun. It's really sexy and it's just so bananas, which is a part of my writing. The heroine in the middle book, the heroine is kind of, you know, in Lion King, when Nala comes to the woods and she's like, Simba, you've got to stop and come back. The pride needs you. So Gabriel was betrothed when he was a baby to an aristocrat, and but then everyone believes he's dead. She hears from a servant that he might still be alive, and she comes and finds him, and she's like, you have to leave and come back and help. And he's like, what? No, I'm not. And of course she knows he is. And so it goes on from there.
Oh, it's going to be so much fun. So Sharice, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Well, it was absolutely my pleasure. These were great questions, and I could talk about books and writing for hours. So this was so much fun for me.
Thank you. You can find Say Yes to the Princess anywhere books are sold, along with all of Sharice's other works. If you would like to keep up to date with Sharice, you can visit her website at www.sharicemichaels.com or on Instagram at @sharicemichaels. All links will be provided in the show notes. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please leave a review or visit me on Instagram at @readlikeash and let me know.